will call in here is Andrew Steve Barrett in Commonwealth, Virginia.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Yes, sir.
I can honestly say I'm back. Madam Clerk, can
Richard
I
Nixon
reserve...
said a long time ago, too.
May I reserve 5 minutes, please, for rebuttal? Your Honor, I'm before this court on an issue of whether or not a stop is legal that occurred on June 4th of 2012 in the county of Chesterfield, Virginia. The issue is whether or not there was reasonable, articulable suspicion to stop the vehicle. The Commonwealth has a problem with their case. And the problem they have with their case is their witnesses. There's an old maxim as a trial attorney that I'm quite sure you all have heard before. The Commonwealth cannot rise any higher than their evidence. And in this instance, if you look at the evidence propounded by the Commonwealth's witnesses, when I've asked questions, the court will understand what I am exactly saying. If you look at the joint appendix on page 129, I asked Detective Parton, and Detective Parton was in charge of the investigation as well as surveillance with regards to my client, Mr. Barrett, and I said to him, query, did you ever see him stop his vehicle on the way from the airport to the Super 8? No. Then question, I'm going to fast forward this to June 4th because on the other days when you observe him give items to people or take bags, you can't say what was in each bag. Is that correct? Answer, no more than speculation. Now let's go to page 133 in the joint appendix. I say, all right, and the reason why you wanted him to be stopped is because you speculated that there was marijuana in those bags. Is that correct? Answer, aye. Question, yes or no? And the answer was yes. Now, the Commonwealth may argue that maybe I'm putting words into the witnesses' mouths, and on some occasions I am guilty of that. But on this occasion, I have an experienced detective using the words speculation, no objective facts, and he says it on more than one occasion. And in the Bible, if you say something at least three times, it has to be a truism. At least in the New Testament. The Old Testament, you need seven times. But by the time the New Testament comes around, God is kind of upset with humanity. But what we do have is a situation in which we have a detective who's in charge of surveillance saying, during cross-examination, I speculated. I had no objective facts. And then when I ask the sergeant who stopped the vehicle, why did you stop the vehicle?
Say I have no objective facts.
Well, he did say that. Detective Parton did. Sergeant Polk, on the other hand, on page 158, says, when I asked him, did he violate any vehicular laws in the presence, in your presence, yes or no? He said, no. Now, why is that important? Because of the pretextual stop issue. First and foremost.
Does a pretextual stop issue win the day for you?
No.
It would not win the day for you. Obviously, we can make a determination that the stop was pretextual, and I think the Commonwealth basically concedes that. But then we could take a look at the reliability information that's in the record. And as I read it, the informant had purchased 20 to 40 pounds of marijuana once a month from the appellant over the course of a year. It provided specific details where the defendant lived, the car he drove, the people he interacted with. In addition, our partner and his team had conducted 46 days of surveillance of appellant, all of which corroborate the informant's tip. They exchanged money or bags with known drug dealers. In other words, we have more stuff than just his thinking that, you know, this might just be a hunch. We have objective facts that we can point to in the record.
Are they? That's the issue here. You see, what we have at the point in time with regards to the stop is a statement in which they're saying that the only reason why they stopped him is because law enforcement said stop him. We think he has marijuana in his car. Okay? Now, the reason why I addressed that issue is because I won that issue downstairs in the circuit court as to pretextual stop. Secondly, the Commonwealth never preserved that issue for appeal. And as such, I'm surprised that it's upstairs. But the third issue is this. If they're arguing pretextual stop, they have a witness saying, hey, I stopped him, but he never violated any laws. And if there's any air freshener arguments, then they have to really contradict what their sergeant actually stated on the stand. Now, as to what was transpiring with the confidential informant, please remember, the confidential informant never was reliable with Detective Parton. The alleged reliability came into play with another detective. And as such, what we heard in
that... Did Detective Parton's 46 days of surveillance corroborate the informant's tip?
What they did was corroborated that something was going on that had an innocent, lawful conduct. Because after all, there is no illegal act for counting money or no illegal criminal act for counting money in public. Now, if they were able to see the possibility of marijuana being exchanged, then that is a scenario where there is an objective fact. Now, there was an objective fact when they went to Ski Lift Drive and they were observing him talk to an individual by the name of Burton, and he walked out of an apartment and there was a smell of marijuana. Now, at that point in time, that was an objective fact that they could have utilized for purposes of stopping my client on that day in question and searching and detaining him. But the reality of the situation, sir, is basically this. If you look at all of the totality of circumstance issues and all the court case law, you'll find that the case law regarding totality of circumstances, which is being utilized here, is based around what happened at that time of that stop. They don't use historical information that goes over a time period of 40 to 60 days.
But why not? I mean, you're just trying to figure out if someone is up to criminal activity or not. And if they are, then you at least stop them to investigate.
Yes, but here's the problem with that. If they believe that he committed criminal activity 45 some days ago or during a time period of a surveillance, when does the probable cause or reasonable articulable suspicion actually stop?
Because well, at some point you run aground on staleness.
Exactly.
But he's engaging in more of this airport and, you know, whatever. So it's an ongoing thing. And in other words, it wasn't like a year ago he was doing something that looked kind of funky, but we're not sure now at this point. I mean, this is all an ongoing course of conduct.
True. It may appear as an ongoing course of conduct for purposes of going to the airport or meeting certain individuals. But the problem is that there's no objective facts to discern whether or not the individuals that he met at the airport were engaged in illegal activity. Because all the confidential informant said was that I had purchased a certain amount of drugs from him over a certain time period. And that the last time I dealt with him was over two some months ago. I don't know where the drugs come from. I don't know how they get to Virginia. I have no information with regards to that specific information.
Didn't the Commonwealth's expert sort of fill in that gap by saying this is the way the drug transactions usually occur? People go to the airport and they exchange things and all that.
No, that's the problem. They had no experts with regards to airport transportation or trafficking. All we had was Detective Parton, who testified to what he observed, and he did state that on several occasions in which he had him under surveillance, he did observe him talking to individuals who have been convicted of drug-related crimes. One of them was Manoy. Another was Mr. Paul Burton. So I will submit to this court that on those occasions when he saw my client talking to or engaged in conversation with these individuals, he may have had reasonable, articulable suspicion to stop them at that point. That's what's important, at that point. But when he went to the airport, he had no objective fact of what was transpiring. He only guessed as to what he thought was happening. Let's look. The bags, for instance. Well, let's go back to something more basic. The ladies who got off the plane, were they the same? No, he couldn't tell.
The thing that was striking to me is the Commonwealth has very wide latitude, or the government in general, in places like train stations and airports because of the heightened security concerns to do a whole lot of stuff like search bags without probable cause, run dogs around, all that. That wasn't done.
Exactly.
But anyway, we're left with what we're left with.
And the fact that the bags were able to be transported without being stopped at the destination when the person got on the plane kind of exemplifies the fact that there has to be some legitimacy as to the travel arrangements. What the Commonwealth failed to establish for an objective fact was whether or not the lady who was delivering these bags were the same person, whether these bags had drugs, whether these bags were used in the course of drug trafficking. In fact, the confidential...
The Commonwealth, in these cases, doesn't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt any of this stuff. It just has to be reasonable, articulable suspicion based on facts of criminal activity. So we're at the investigative phase.
Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely correct, sir. But the problem is this. The police officer said he speculated.
Well, so suppose...
Do we rely on the subjective intent of the officer or the objective facts?
Well, we have to rely on the objective statements of the police officer, because the police officer said, I speculated. So are we here to say today that he didn't speculate, that Mr. Jackson put those words in his mouth?
Suppose the officer in Terry, the landmark case, had said, yeah, I was speculating as to whether they were casing the jewelry store.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. Supreme Court, of course, said, well, that was enough for a Terry stop. But if add that additional fact, would that have sunk Terry versus
Ohio? Terry v. Ohio had a little bit more than just observation. That Terry, I believe, it's been a while, and please correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm running into my rebuttal at this point in time. But there was a little bit more to Terry because there was also an issue of danger as well, if I recollect correctly.
But, and while you're waiting on your rebuttal time after hearing from your opponent colleague, why don't you take a look at the appendix pages 86, 87, 94, 95, and 98 through 101. It said, appellant made frequent trips to the airport to randomly pick up luggage or a woman who would leave her luggage in his car. Detective Parton, admitted by the trial court as an expert on drug distribution, appendix at page 76, testified that appellant's actions over the course of the 46 days were consistent with drug distribution, which goes to my question earlier about...
And consistent with drug distribution with regards to the 46 days of observing my client go to parking lots and to different locations and talking to individuals, dropping off bags, picking up bags, counting money. That was what that was referencing, sir.
Okay.
Because there was something that the circuit court judge had issues reconciling, is the fact that there was nobody in court to testify as to what transpired at the airport, and who would be an expert on that subject matter.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
The rest for you, Bob.
May it please the court, I'm Susan Baumgartner for the Commonwealth. Your Honor, reasonable suspicion does not evaporate in the midst of an investigation in which, block by block, the police are confirming further investigative steps, further crimes committed by the defendant.
I found the argument intriguing. Is there a criminal equivalent to Massey versus Firmstone about rising above your witnesses' statements, et cetera?
And specifically, the
comments by the detective, repeated comments about the content of the bags was speculation.
Well, I will say that he also testified exactly why he thought Mr. Barrett had marijuana with him, and he was very detailed. He had a lot of objective facts as to why he believed the suitcases contained marijuana.
Right. I guess the point that Judge McCullough is trying to make, and that I understand his point to be, and he can correct me if I'm wrong on this, is that if the government's star witness, and I'm using that term loosely, says that I just had these suspicions, and I'm not saying that I've had reasonable articulable suspicion or probable cause, I just thought something was kind of fishy here, that's the context of the statement. Is the government stuck with that from a constitutional analytical framework?
No. The same way is if the detective said both, I saw him and his car was green, and I saw him and his car was white. If the Commonwealth wins below, the inference is there, you disregard the other.
Yeah, I'm just testimony. Trying to figure out if there's any case law that supports the notion about, you know, a witness, a key witness says something, and then even though surrounding facts allow a sensible inference to the contrary, You know, and on the civil side, there's always this battle about Massey versus Burnstone, which has been whittled down to just a little nub, more or less. And I just don't know that there's much equivalent on the criminal side that we have to contend with.
I guess the response would be something to the effect that even if the government's witness says that I'm only suspicious or whatever, if the trial judge or as a fact finder determines that it is not mere speculation or suspicion and goes and says that this is more than a mere hunch or suspicion, the fact that a witness has conceded a legal point is not binding on the trial court.
Yeah. Well, certainly in habeas law, if a defense attorney says I was ineffective, that's not binding on the court. Similarly, I had a case, I believe it's Tramon Antonio Johnson from last year, where the witness testified he lost consciousness, but also constantly talked about what he observed while he was supposedly unconscious. And this court found that maybe he was using unconscious incorrectly. The same way I would say perhaps this detective was using speculation because it is not as though he had no reason to believe there was marijuana in these suitcases.
I think that's a perfectly sensible point. I just want to make sure we're not running afoul of some precedent out there or at least that we address the application of that precedent in this particular context where this detective made certain statements.
I am unaware of any such precedent, but should you wish for supplemental briefing, of course, we'd be happy to do so. In this case, we had multiple pieces of the puzzle, multiple steps of the investigation that kept confirming the police officer's belief that ultimately Mr. Barrett was carrying marijuana, and the objective fact is he was carrying 50 pounds of marijuana when the police stopped him.
Well, I mean, we can't bootstrap that, you know, at the back end.
But correct. But what we had was a CI, a known CI, who Detective Parton had worked with. Detective Parton, starting on page 212, testifies that he'd been working with the CI for several months, that the CI had always given him correct information, and that there had been 6 previous traffickers arrested based on the CI's information. In addition, the CI provided verifiable information about Mr. Barrett.
Interaction with known drug dealers, handing off bags and cash, suspicious conduct at the airport. I mean, he's not cab driver, limousine driver, where he's just picking these people up. It's odd what he's doing with the bags, you know, where the person drops off the bag, gets dropped off at a hotel, doesn't retain the bag that they brought into the airport. So we have a wealth of facts in terms of supporting what is fundamentally a fairly low threshold of reasonable articulable suspicion.
Absolutely. All the evidence confirms that he's dealing drugs, and the CI also said the drugs are coming in from out of state.
Or at least that he may be, and therefore we get to stop him to investigate.
Correct. They stopped him, and that's the point of it. They are allowed to stop him to investigate to confirm their suspicions. They're reasonable suspicions in this case. His only out-of-state contact was with the airport, and he was behaving as though those women were couriers. He was picking them up, keeping their bags, taking them back to the airport without bags. Under these steps, there was certainly enough for the court to refuse to suppress. Briefly on the issue of whether the court had the power to suppress, I think it's fundamental. Or had the power to reopen and reconsider its hearsay decision. I think that's a very fundamental part of the court's power, that it can choose to accept evidence in the order it wants to accept it. It can reconsider decisions it has made that were mistaken.
Like maybe it should have done in the other case with that.
If there are no further questions, I urge you to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll be very brief. What I felt was very compelling was the statement of the judge when he ruled initially on my motion to suppress. He said, frankly, my problem is I frankly was waiting to hear one of those experts say that it was common for drugs to be transported by airplane in suitcases. Now, I will concede that you have reasonable, articulable suspicion throughout the 45 to 46 days in which my client was meeting individuals at odd places and also exchanging money or giving the individuals packages and bags and things of that nature. But where does that reasonable, articulable suspicion stop? We don't have any objective facts as to the airport. Now, I will submit that there was one day in which he went to the airport and did a very peculiar act with some bags. Now, with the reasonable, articulable suspicion that the police had prior to that date and the actions that my client had performed at the airport, I would submit that on that day, they could have stopped him legitimately, because of the fact that his actions were not in concert with a traveler. And if you look at that in conjunction with the prior surveillance, then one can argue that there's reasonable, articulable suspicion. But on a day in which you have a female coming out who has no basis for being under surveillance, in which you don't know her destination, and you don't know exactly if she was here prior or on a previous occasion, that is not a day when reasonable, articulable suspicion attaches based on the surveillance, because it could have conceivably been his wife. It could have been lawful conduct. And with the Commonwealth...
But don't the cases say that's always a possibility? I mean, the individuals in Terry may have just been hesitant shoppers who kept checking out the jewelry in the store window.
Exactly.
So the case law says there is a risk that this conduct is actually innocent.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we do with that? I mean, it may well have been his wife, in which case, sorry, we shouldn't have stopped you.
But at the same time, at that point in time, what they have is a stop which gives them the ability to do a limited intrusion. Okay? What we have at this point in stage is not a limited intrusion, but a full-blown detention, because it was their belief that there was drugs in the car. They were trying to justify the ends or the means by having a result of 50 pounds of marijuana. You know, the means justify the ends. So this was not a minor detention. It was a full-blown detention designed based on what they thought or believed could be there, and that was based on what? A hunch, speculation. Now, I understand this court is saying that, well, we can interpret the facts in contrary to that of the witness. But the fact is this: we have an experienced law enforcement individual who has been on many investigations. He knows his words. He's not a four-year-old who says no and shakes his head yes. He understands everything that he is saying and knows the significance of what he is saying. And now...
Your time's expired and we get the significance of what
you're saying. Oh, I have 43 seconds.
You do?
You're 46. 3 seconds in excess of...
Oh, okay, the one is going up.
Okay.
My apologies, but nevertheless, Your Honors, I ask you to consider my arguments and to affirm my position. Thank you.
Thank you.